Mr. Atkin's real thought.
Yes, we got to where we were talking about the Germans coming down, and they did not take Tobruk. That had been stoutly defended by the Australian forces, and did so continuously until we'll develop that story as we go along. We were based in Merseyrail Matru, and there was a lot of hard work we had to put in to dig out all the fortifications because they'd been covered in drift sand and goodness knows what. But fortunately for us, the Germans didn't come any further than up on the plateau above Saloum. Fort Capuzzo, I think, was probably the furthest place, and surrounding outposts, Sidi Omer comes to mind as one of the names. And he came to a full stop. Now, at the same time as that was happening, Greece and Crete was happening. Now, I can tell you nothing about Greece, except to tell you that I remember very well when we eventually got back to the base, of seeing many hundreds of our own troops who had been evacuated from Greece coming back looking very, very sorry for themselves.
Which base?
That would be down in El Casasin, I think, along the banks of the Suez Canal, anyway, around that area outside Cairo. And I personally was able to see them because, again, being an MT driver, I drove from A to B here and there and everywhere, and one saw this. But more intimately concerned was the battalion in the Crete affair. So, would you like me to sort of tell you about that?
Please.
Does that sort of, this takes it in sequence, logical sequence. I've got a whole history of this here, but
well, do it from memory.
Yeah, do it from memory, right. Now, after we were no longer required in Merseyrail Matru because of the forces were able to halt the Germans. We were required as a battalion to carry out local airfield defences around the desert, again, for obvious reasons, sabotage and that sort of thing. So the battalion was scattered far and wide over that particular area of the desert for a week or so. And in the meantime, the Greece affair had deteriorated to the extent where the evacuation came about. And then that progressed on to the Crete affair, when the Germans suddenly, we heard over the news that the Germans had attacked Crete with a very large airborne forces and very heavy aircraft attacking. And once again, the British forces were few and far between. Many demands were being made on them. And Wavell was very hard pushed to provide enough troops to go across and try and protect Crete. We did have troops there, and they were troops that had been evacuated from Greece. And they were put into Crete basically to defend that island. But they didn't really have enough time to get themselves sorted out from the evacuation from Greece, and were not really sufficiently equipped with the right weapons to deal with that type of an invasion. Now, whilst the battle was progressing, demands were made for more troops to go to help them to hold Crete. There was a very high political goings on here between Winston Churchill and General Wavell. General Wavell was saying, well, I haven't got the troops to spare. I've got Rommel on my back door. We've got the Italians down further south in the Abyssinian area to look after. The Syrian crisis was beginning to rear its head. And he said, I just have not got the troops to spare, but I'll do my best. As far as our battalion was concerned, we were suddenly given notice to go helter-skelter back to a place called Amaria, just outside Alexandria, where we were then to get ourselves prepared to go on board ship and be part of a reinforcement force to go to Crete. This subsequently took place, I should think, towards the, if I remember rightly, towards the end of May. About then, anyway. And we were put onto a ship called the Glenroy, which is one of the ships, a fairly recently built ship, not particularly designed as an infantry landing ship, but was acquired by the government and became a transport for infantry as a troop ship. It was equipped with some landing craft of a very sort of early type nature. And we eventually set sail from Alexandria. Again, the exact date eludes me, but we sailed, and for the first few hours, of course, all was all very nice. But during the first journey out, having been at sea for a couple of hours, we witnessed our own fleet coming back very badly battered. I remember distinctly seeing one of the aircraft carriers, which was either the Illustrious or the Victorious, had been badly hit and was listing very badly. Several cruisers, which appeared to me as a soldier looking on as if there was only half the ship there. Either its stern or its bows had been blown away. The control towers and all that had been rather badly battered with. They'd been very severely bombed by the Stukas. Our own escort of ships was the anti-aircraft carrier Coventry and some destroyers, and they were used as a screen very far out. We'd been out the first day and the first night, I think, other than those incidents I've just related, went reasonably quiet. But the second day turned into a rather an uncomfortable situation. One has to remember that we had no aircraft support because the aircraft was either, it wasn't there, and if it was, it didn't have the capabilities of reaching that far out. So the Germans had complete control of the air in and around Crete, I should say for 100 or 200 miles out from that island. And there we were. The first intimation of we were in for a hammering was over the Tannoy. And the story goes that the Coventry would pick up the aircraft coming in because she had what they called in those days an early radar. Very, very early stages of that radar at that time, but they were able to pick up aircraft at about 30 or 40 miles distance, and they would signal back the air raid warning, and our own system would then pick it up, and the captain would have it over the Tannoy, aircraft warning yellow, action gun crew stand by, all personnel not required on the upper deck, go below. And a few minutes later, aircraft warning red, action gun crews close up, and all personnel below lay down, face down, head inboard, and put your arms and hands over your heads. Now, I can assure you that that gives you a feeling of sheer, not panic, but concern, if anything else. And then the bomb started coming down. And the noise and the pandemonium that must have gone on the upper decks would have had to been seen to be believed. But we were carrying, besides our own stuff, something like about 14,000 gallons of petrol for refueling and that sort of thing for transport on the upper decks. And again, in those days, our petrol was carried in flimsy 4-gallon tins. I wonder if you've heard this before.
I've heard of the flimsies.
Yes. And they would not stand up to much battering about. Well, you can imagine the effect that vibration from near misses, from bombs coming down and pieces of shrapnel flying all over the place, would have had on it. And eventually, the petrol on fore and after the ship began and caught fire. And this is the highlight of that trip. We were all down below, expecting any minute for something to come straight in and we were going to go down. That's all. And we could do nothing about it. Not the ordinary soldier. We just lay down there and had to take it. And the people up on deck probably were the more fortunate because they could see what was coming. They were firing their guns and they were occupied. But to be unoccupied in circumstances like that is not a very nice thing to experience. However, we could tell the stages of the raid and how it was going because, first of all, our own ship did have some heavy guns on, reasonably heavy, which you could hear them let off to the aircraft as it was fairly high up. Now, the battalion, the regiment, had also supplied all of its battalion's Bren guns, and they were mounted on the upper decks and all around the bridge. So, as the Stukas began their diving to come in and attack, firstly you'd have the heavy gun, then you'd have what we called the pom-poms. Now, when you heard the Bren guns starting to open up, you knew that something very, very serious was going to happen. And eventually, in the midst of all that noise going on, you felt the ship lift up out of the water, vibrate, shake, and goodness knows what. And that was very, very scary, quite honestly. And then, during one of those stages of those attacks, The captain obviously could see that the ship had to be turned away from Crete because so as to divert the flame and the smoke from causing any further hazards that it might do. And this meant us going away from Crete for a time. At the same time as that happened, this one particular incident always reminds in my mind very vividly. Suddenly, a voice shouted down the hatchway for gas masks. Now, a lot of us didn't hear that quite right, and all we heard was the word gas. Now, instantaneously, on my mess deck anyway, it may not have happened throughout the ship, but on the mess deck that I was on, there was suddenly everybody got up and made a rush for their respirator. You see, because we thought it was a gas attack. And it was only the presence of mind of another very young sergeant who brought us to heel. I was an MT sergeant at that time, but I didn't act all that bravely, but he did. He had a presence of mind of saying, "It's not gas, it's gas masks, because they are fighting fire and the smoke upstairs, up in the upper decks. Calm down." And that instantly brought everybody back to a normal state of mind. But that was an incident that was most unpleasant. But anyway, the final result of that was, because the ship had to divert away from the intended Crete landing, there was no way were we going to be able to get there without being further hammered by the German Stukas and aircraft. It would have been absolute suicide to have gone in. We would not have reached Crete, even in the final stages. When you remember that the number of ships that was actually sunk around there, and we were a slow plodding troop ship, there's no way would we have got there. And Admiral Cunningham, in his wisdom, ordered the ship back to Alexandria. On the way back, we had a couple of minor raids, but nothing to speak of. And we eventually got back to Alexandria, not in one piece, but at least safe from Davy Jones's locker. We thought that we were... Then that was the end of the episode for us. But again, high political... not interference, but a high, well, in a way it was, said Churchill, I know, through all the history books I've read, absolutely said to Wavell, look, you jolly well got to do something. You must. And he made one more effort, and we were put back onto the blasted ship and told to sail once more, make one more effort.
Onto the Glen Roy.
Yes, on the Glen Roy, yes. And they did what they could. She was still obviously serviceable in that sense, but she was a bit battered. And then we made a second attempt. And, of course, we walked into the same sort of reception. And I think at that stage also it was fully understood by Admiral Cunningham, General Wavell, and... The general in charge of Crete at the time, who was that very well-known Australian chap who won the VC...
Freyberg,
that's right, yes, that the situation was completely hopeless and that they would have to withdraw. So we turned about and went back to Alexandria and disembarked and went back into the base called Amaria. The history of the evacuation of Crete, of course, has been told by people who were... actually involved in it, but it was a very unpleasant little interlude. It doesn't rank with all the big major battles from what I've just told you, but nevertheless it took part took place.
Did you go to the front in the Western Desert or elsewhere then?
No, but no, the next stage is the interesting one, because having got back from Crete, the Syrian episode reared its ugly head, which was about June of, 41 was it?
Yes.
I forgot to mention that, of course, whilst we were at sea on the Glen Roy, we received that awful news that HMS Hood had been sunk. So that was another cause for thought, wasn't it? If they could sink a jolly great big ship like that, then what could they do with ours? we were in Amaria, and I think we got sent back again down to El Tag or Cassidy, and I'm not too sure about that. But eventually the Syrian crisis broke upon us, and I think for those who don't know, this was where the British French, as they were called, who were in association with the Germans, were either threatening or did allow the Germans certain passages and encroachment onto Syrian territory. And the British government decided that could not be, for obvious reasons. There was Iran, Iraq, Persia, whatever we called it at that time, in being, and the oil wells. Don't think they were quite so developed as they are now, but they were there. And so the next sudden instruction we get. We're sitting peacefully in the camp one night, and suddenly it's all hands to the mast or whatever, and we were told that we were on the move, and we were moving into Palestine, and going on into Syria. Now that meant another very long journey from the Nile Delta, right the way back again across the Sinai Desert, which we'd crossed on the outward journey, and which we were about to recross. And I travelled that entire length of that desert on a motorcycle. So as an MT sergeant, controlling the convoy or whatever was necessary. And that was a very hard ride. We negotiated the journey into Palestine without any trouble whatsoever. And we went back to our old haunt in a place called Nethanya. And we'd been there for maybe a day and a half. And we were, obviously, the CO was waiting for orders of what was required of us. And a lot of the lads who'd been there and were old hands at that went out to meet previous acquaintances, i.e. girlfriends, etc., etc. I didn't. I was still in camp at the time when about midnight we got an order, move. And they had to send out people all over the little town of Nethanya calling the wayward ones back to camp, which they did, no bother, because it was a very good battalion, very good morale of the regiment in the Palestine days. And in those Western Desert days was superb. Very good regiment. Well, I say so myself, it was. We got onto a transport, and again, as MT sergeant, I was doing the motorcycle at the time, riding the motorcycle, controlling the convoy, or helping to control it. And we set off for Syria. And that meant going right up the length of Palestine, right up through Lake Tiberias, and up to the border where it borders Syria, which I think now is referred to as the Golan Heights, or in that area. And we eventually crossed into Syria at a place called Dera. That's been mentioned several times in recent history. And we then were receiving sort of orders, countermanding orders, counter orders, and all sorts of things. But eventually, they decided that we were required on an area which was going to be the main advance onto to Damascus. Our first sign of opposition was at a place called Kenitra in Syria, where the Vichy French began to make a stand. Nothing great, but it was it resulted in us having several casualties. But eventually we overcame that and moved into Kenitra, passing several French vehicles on fire and that sort of thing. And then we carried on moving forward until we came into the foothills. I think it's of the Jebel. I think they called it the Jebel something. I can't quite remember. But as we move deeper into the hills going towards Damascus, it is here that not only our battalion, but most of the people forming the force designated to take over Syria came up against rather more stronger opposition than they thought was there. Now, it comes to the stage here where the battalion eventually was sent into the hills to attack several of the French, Vichy French, defensive positions, barring our way through the hills to Damascus. And One particular prominent feature was known as Hill 1634, of which our battalion was told it had to take. The French artillery was very, very prominent in this particular area. And I believe it was discovered after hostilities finished there that it had been the French school of artillery for that area. And they'd been able to register all the feasible places for advancing, as probably you might know. And whenever any of our troops showed their faces on the down through the low hills and the passes and that, the French artillery just opened fire and plastered the place. And that became a little bit uncomfortable, quite honestly. But the battalion eventually moved in and was in the foothills around 1634, and then began the unpleasant progress of process of trying to eliminate the French positions. I personally cannot tell you the severity of the hand-to-hand fighting or the closeness of the fighting, because again, as the MT sergeant, perhaps I was fortunate in I remained with B echelon, which was rather farther back from the actual fighting line. So my own experiences then was to ensure that the transport was available each night to take up our reinforcements and hot food for the troops, because they just lived on bully beef and biscuits and water during the day because they couldn't move because of the Vichy French artillery fire and opposition. There's a certain little story here I want to tell you about this Syrian campaign.
Please.
It was in my mind, and I'm just trying to think about it.